Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Tierney ou le grand pont pour éliminer Furlong. Qu'est-ce qu'il lui a fait là? Qu'est-ce qu'il lui fait, Kieran Tierney? Kieran Tierney, c'est quoi? C'est quoi ça? Il vient souhaiter une très bonne année aux supporters d'Arsenal. Kieran Tierney, quel rush! Magnifique! Magnifique! Magnifique!
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too, Andrew. How you doing?
I'm all right. I am ever so slightly hungover today.
Same. Yeah. Same.
It was a beautiful day here in Ireland. It wasn't necessarily the sunniest day we've ever had, but it was certainly one of the warmest, even though really? It was overcast. It was lovely and warm. The air was warm. So I spent basically the entire day in the back garden cooking things and drinking things. And I also got this, like a fire pit, you know, those kind of things?
Yeah.
It's a bowl, though. It's this bowl that sits there and it projects the fire out in front of you. So I lit a fire and it went on until a little bit later in the evening than I maybe should have. But there you go.
Don't worry, we won't judge you for that.
Yeah. How about you? You were there.
I was at Wembley.
You were at Wembley. How was it?
The England-Croatia game. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was one of those where it was quite an early kickoff. It was like 2 o'clock. So I was in the pub at like 11 or something. it'd be like when you go to an airport and you have a drink before getting on the plane, it's a weird time.
Yeah.
But it meant that by the evening, I was slightly worse for wear.
Mm.
So I'm not 100% today, but I really enjoyed it. It was a really good day and the atmosphere was predominantly really good. Where we were sort of sat, there was a few Croatian fans around us and had a good chat with them and everyone was in really good spirits. So, yeah, it was nice. It was, 20,000 people or something in a stadium felt like an awful lot. I kind of kept thinking, is this going to feel very subdued and not like the real deal? But it is amazing how much difference that many fans can make.
It didn't look like 20,000. I have to say, I was, looking at the TV coverage, I was like, there's hardly anyone there, but maybe it's just because Wembley is so big and everyone was spread out, but
yeah, I also wondered if, I don't know, looking at where I was sat, like the lower tier and the upper tier seemed quite sparsely populated, but then somewhat unsurprisingly, the kind of corporate tier around the middle seemed a little bit more full. So I wonder if that partly explained it, but I agree with you, it didn't look as many as advertised. But yeah, it was just great to be at a game. And it's not the kind of the normal international tournament experience for lots of reasons. I mean, mainly that it's all being played in different countries. But just to see that many fans congregating together was great.
Is that your first game as a fan with fans back?
Second, I went to the Europa League game Arsenal played in like October. You know, they won like 5-1 or something.
When there was like 2,000 people there.
Yeah, Lacazette smashed one in from very far out. I went to that, but it wasn't the same. People I were with had been to kind of cup finals and the like, FA Cup finals, Champions League finals. And but it was, I think maybe as well, the fact that it wasn't a split crowd, really. I mean, it was, I would imagine, 90% England fans in there. That probably helped because it meant the vast majority of that 20,000 were kind of pulling in the same direction. So, yeah, it was really good. I mean, there's talk, isn't there, potentially of the semi-finals and final being up to 50% capacity at Wembley. I think that would feel positively spine-tingling, frankly, in the circumstances.
Yeah. And what did you make of the game and the performance and all of that? Because I was watching it, I wasn't particularly enamoured with the game.
I think it was a great game, to be honest with you. We were kind of saying we imagined that for a neutral it was probably not a thriller. Croatia weren't brilliant at all. England were very workmanlike and organised, and it was a bit of a moment of inspiration from Calvin Phillips that got them the goal in the end. But it's not like they created a plethora of chances beyond that. But they did get the result. And, you know, the first win in any group stage, in any international competition, really matters. I mean, it puts England in a strong position. The way the competition is structured, you're almost guaranteed to go through with one win, because I think half of the third place teams end up going through to the knockouts this time.
Right.
England are in a good, strong position now. They've probably beaten the toughest opposition in the group. But I'm really fascinated by the next game, England-Scotland. I mean, that will be spicy, to say the least.
Yeah, there's some rivalry there, isn't there, for
a little bit,
reason.
Yeah, they still seem a bit aggrieved about a few things that have happened in the past. So, which I can appreciate.
A common theme with England at times, that.
Yeah, that's true. We've got a lot of countries who don't like us. But, and listen, I mean, it was obviously there was a lot of controversy around the taking the knee and what would happen there. I can only speak for sort of where I was stood and my section of the support. It felt like it was massively drowned out. Any kind of opposition, people were really supportive and clapping and cheering. But there was still an audible element of the fan base that, you know, wanted to make themselves heard against that, which I was really disappointed by. I kind of thought maybe this is my snobbery speaking, but I thought maybe in London, you know, there wouldn't be a trace of that. And maybe that was a bit naive on my part, because there very much was.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, look, there are people filming themselves booing at their own televisions, you know, so this has reached ludicrous proportions, really. And I think, you know, look, I'm glad to hear it was drowned out for the most part.
It definitely was. It definitely was. And
he spoke well about it last week, didn't he, Gareth Southgate? You know, whatever people think about him as a manager, I think in the last week or so, and he wrote that piece for the, was it the Players Tribune? Which is a good read, and he spoke very well about it last week. And,
And I think that's a huge part of the job, to be honest with you. Mm. You know, speaking as a kind of England fan, I would much rather have someone who's sort of a good, I mean, statesman, you know, in some ways, than I would someone who was a maybe effective coach, but an absolute wanker. Like, I think the job is kind of bigger than what happens on the pitch in some respects.
Well, and certainly at the moment, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, and Southgate understands that, I think, and I think it makes him very well suited to it. Ideally, you want both, you know, but I was reminded a little bit of Arsenal's trouble at left back towards the end of last season when I was watching England, because they had Kieran Trippier, obviously, playing as a left back, which raised a few eyebrows and certainly inhibited them a bit on that flank going forward.
Yeah, that was a surprise. Yeah, it was a surprise selection, I guess, given he's got, Luke Shaw and Chilwell in the squad.
And Bukayo Saka, if required.
Well, yes, and nobody wants to play him at left back except me, it seems. an interesting how would you describe that selection? Was it specific for this particular opposition, or what was the thinking behind that?
I think they're a bit worried about Tyrone Mings, who's the left-sided centre-half. He's kind of playing because Harry Maguire's out, and maybe they wanted Trippier on that side to just give a bit more stability and cover. I think they want to play Trippier because of set pieces. He's got good delivery. Yeah. But then he's picked a shit ton of right backs, hasn't he? And he's got Kyle Walker and Reece James as well to consider. I don't know. I don't know if he'll stick with it. I wonder if against Scotland he might be a little bit more expansive, and it might have just been something that was required to get past Croatia. But we shall see. Bukayo Saka, named on the England bench ahead of £100 million rated Jadon Sancho, who didn't make the cut. So
he's got to be worth more than £100 million. Is that what you're saying?
£100 million and one. In typical Arsenal fashion. No, I didn't see him, obviously. Saka didn't get on. Not sure how much we will see him, to be honest, in the tournament, but maybe there'll be some minutes for him in the remaining two group games.
Did you see any of the other games yesterday? I did not watch Austria versus North Macedonia.
I did see some of that one because I was still in the pub, and actually there was some nice moments. I mean, a really great opening goal from Austria. I don't know if you've seen it since, but no, Sabitzer plays a kind of pinged crossfield pass. And the guy takes it on the volley, sort of into the corner first time. It's just I don't know what other people thought of it, but I loved that as a goal. It's kind of a pinged diagonal pass that's scored on the volley at the far post. And then Goran Pandev scored his first international tournament goal at, I think, 34 or something. He's been around forever. But it's finally got to grace a big tournament.
Actually, read a good piece on him yesterday. By Nick Ames in The Guardian. It's well worth checking out if you can take a look.
He's had a very good career, but kind of obviously never really had much opportunity to make an impact at this level. I saw bits and bobs of that. I wish I'd watched the Holland game. I didn't. I've caught the highlights since. But that seemed like a really fun match.
That second half in particular was really fun. Some good goals. A bit of a comeback from Ukraine, and then
was it 0-0 at half time?
0-0 at half time.
Wow, and then just went crazy.
Yeah, went crazy. Some really dodgy goalkeeping, I have to say.
That always helps.
Yeah, that always helps. So, you know, it was a fun game to watch in the garden last night, which was great because I got this new Wi-Fi extender and it lashes the Wi-Fi out into the garden so I can watch on my iPad, which is lovely. I didn't think I'd be able to. I was sort of torn between going inside but then staying outside on such a lovely evening. So
that's great. A Wi-Fi extender that works is an invaluable thing.
Yeah.
You've done well there.
Yeah, we had a question about the guy that scored the winning goal, actually. I can't remember. Let me see here.
Oh, Denzel Dumfries.
Yeah, the Bruised Banana podcast said, is there a better name in world football than Denzel Dumfries? or Dumfries. I mean, I think there probably is a need for more Hollywood stars mixed up with Scottish towns. You know what I mean? Like Brad Aberdeen or Samuel L. Kilmarnock would be amazing footballer names.
Yeah, he's a curious player as well. He's been linked with a move to the Premier League a couple of times. We did one of those kind of scouting pieces on The Athletic about right back, and statistically he pops out because he's incredibly athletic and, you know, gets forward really well. He's still playing in Holland, I think, for PSV. But he is also slightly clumsy with his delivery. I saw someone on Twitter comparing him to kind of a right-sided Sead Kolasinac, and there is something to that. But he made a big impact last night, was involved, I think, in all Netherlands goals, should have scored another one himself, and did score the winner. I don't think he's right for us, but I think he's tailor-made for the Premier League. I bet we see him here at some point.
Interesting, interesting. Leonardo Dundee, there's another guy. Nice goal. I'm just watching that Austrian goal. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, it's a nice goal, right? Yeah. It's kind of very visually satisfying.
Yeah. He's another player we've been linked with a bit, isn't he, Sabitzer? He seems to be available at a relatively knockdown price this summer, and for a club that's looking for, I guess, some value in the market, he might be of interest.
Yeah, how old is he? He's 27. So, you know,
can't do it.
He's not allowed. Can't do it. Well, yeah, the Thomas Partey rule in effect. I do think Arsenal are, we'll come on to this no doubt, but looking in a younger age bracket this summer predominantly. But I like him as a player as well. I think he's really talented. Scored some pretty spectacular goals in his time as well. What are we talking about? Oh, the Holland-Ukraine game. The other thing I just want to say about that is how much I loved the contrast in the kits. It was a very visually satisfying game to watch. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I like it. I always, you know, since like the 1978 World Cup final when the Netherlands lost to Argentina, and I was pretty much inconsolable because I was up for the Netherlands. I was watching it from under a chair. I was allowed to stay up late and watch it. I've always liked the Holland kit, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a thing of beauty. And yeah, it's just really, I forget, were Ukraine wearing blue last night? Very possibly, but there was like a really nice contrast. I was annoyed, you know, I've been a bit annoyed about some of the kits. Italy, of course, played in white on Friday.
Yeah. They
should have been in blue. Things like that really get my goat. Focusing on the big matters at hand.
Sure.
Yeah, so it was been a kind of weird weekend. I kind of feared for the tournament a little bit on Saturday with what happened to Christian Eriksen. It was obviously so shocking and arresting. Mm. You kind of feel like, how do we move forward from
yeah.
here? But fortunately, I think the good news about his condition has kind of enabled that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Hust says, good morning, gents. Have you been affected by the events in Copenhagen on Saturday? And it was genuinely harrowing, wasn't it, to see it happen, to see him fall and the way he stumbled and just the
Were
way...
Were you watching live?
I sort of was in the kitchen and I heard them talking about it and then went in and started watching. And then just sort of when something like that happens and you see the seriousness immediately of a situation like that and an athlete, and we've seen it in the past where, you know, I mean, look, they said the Danish team doctor came out, didn't he, and said he was gone, basically. Mm. He was gone. And they, you know, were able to perform CPR and defibrillators and all of that, which, you know, thankfully saved his life. But when something like that happens in real time and you're looking at it, you can't help but fear the worst, you know, because it is such a, what's the way to put this? Like, it's just such a shocking health event. I don't quite know what I'm trying to say here, but you know what I mean? It's so quick and so sudden that you fear that the outcome is going to be negative. I don't know how I don't know how those players were able to go out and play. Genuinely.
No, I mean, that kind of seemed crazy to me, to be honest. I know they were given a choice of playing the following day and they decided to do it that day, and apparently Christian Eriksen expressed his wishes that they go on and play the game. But I was amazed at that, to be honest. And obviously, sort of the game itself and the result paled into insignificance as opposed to trying to get some updates and good news about his condition. And I think you're right, it was absolutely shocking. How did it affect me? I'll tell you precisely how it affected me. I'd had a row with my wife not long before. Not a big row, just like a disagreement. I can't even remember what about.
Mm.
And when that happened, I was watching the BBC coverage and Alex Scott said, oh, I've just called my mum and told her I love her. And as kind of cheesy as this sounds, the same thing happened in my home where I was like, I can't believe we're having a stupid row about, you know, who left the... I don't know, washing machine on or something. Whatever ridiculous domestic.
Trivial, yeah, completely trivial.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It just really put all that in perspective. And also, you know, it puts things like football rivalries in perspective. I mean, Christian Eriksen's a guy with a big history at Spurs who, you know, I don't think any Arsenal fan thinks of too fondly. But suddenly when it's placed in that context with that degree of seriousness, you immediately see people's humanity, you know, cut across that. And that's absolutely right. But it's also quite heartwarming and reassuring. And you know, as shocking as it was, I guess one thing I would say is, like, apart from a hospital, there probably aren't many better places for that to happen.
You're right.
Surrounded by equipment and medical staff, and I think it's a rule since the Fabrice Moremba thing, I think there have to be defibrillators on site in stadiums. So that gave him a chance. And obviously he's a very fit guy. But man, he's a very lucky guy too.
He is.
Yeah.
It was...
What a relief.
Yeah, it really was. It was just... those moments where you're trying to wonder what's going to happen with him, and you're hoping for the best possible outcome. And yeah, I have to say, I was really, even on Sunday morning when I wrote about it a bit for the blog, I was just like, oh, fuck, this is... You know, I'm relieved and glad and happy that the worst didn't happen, but it's still really tough to witness something like that and to sort of have this collective fear that I think everybody felt, you know? And what we felt watching from afar and with a certain amount of distance, you know, as you say, I'm not Danish. I'm not a Spurs fan. Wasn't at the game. You know, these things provide us with distance from him, if you like. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the people who were there, who were his friends and his family and his teammates and the fans in the stadium who were in close proximity to this, I can't even imagine what it was like for them to endure those moments and that period of time where we weren't sure what was going to happen with him. So for them to come out and play, even if Christian Eriksen wanted them to go on and wanted them to play and gave them the A-OK and everything else. I mean, I get the sense that, you know, UEFA... I mean, the UEFA thing really annoyed me. I have to say, in that, you know, they made an announcement on Twitter which said, you know, the match is going to go ahead, blah, 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 and the player has been transferred to hospital and is stabilized, something like that.
Mm-mm-mm.
And I think it really said something about their corporate outlook or mindset that the first update was not about the player's health. It was about the match going ahead again. You know what I mean? It was really... Yeah. I found that really poor. Somebody in the UEFA communications department needs to have a good talk with themselves about how that was presented and everything else. So, I mean, it must have been just genuinely traumatic for players on both sides. I mean, have you ever been in a football match where someone's got badly injured? Have you ever played in one where someone's been badly injured? I played in one where a guy broke his leg once.
Yeah, and I think a broken ankle. Yeah, yeah. I have played in one.
I played him where a guy broke his leg once, and it's like that's an injury, and it's not nice. But it's, as injuries go, a pretty simple one to fix. It's painful, and it takes a bit of time. But generally speaking, you know, stick him in a plaster, and you know, go around on crutches for 6 weeks, and you can start to get better again. But even something like that was, I remember at the time, quite. Had an impact on all the players, you know, on our team and their team. So to see somebody nearly die, I just can't really get my head around it. And I think credit to, you know, obviously the medical staff and the people who saved his life, their training and everything else. And look, anybody can learn how to do CPR. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you don't know and you, you know, maybe you play football on a Friday with your mates like I do, you know, learning how to do CPR properly is important, wasn't it? What's the player's name? Simon Kerr? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah.
You know, who turned him on his side and made sure he didn't swallow his tongue and things like that can aid in the other efforts to save his life.
Definitely. Yeah, that intervention probably really critical, you know.
Yeah. So I just like it's the professionalism of the players after everything they've been through. You know, in the last 12, 18 months, I think we forget sometimes that these guys are human and the schedules that they've been exposed to and the amount of, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, footballers get out there and do football for our entertainment. The nation will be, you know, cheered up by you guys playing football. You know what I mean?
It's your duty.
It is your duty. I mean, that's what it was. That's almost what it was like. And look, they're very privileged. We know that. They're privileged in the sense that they're well paid. They're doing something for a living that we would all love to do. They have the privilege or the benefit of, you know, testing and being able to exist in these kind of, in inverted commas, safe bubbles. You know what I mean? But there must have been, over the course of this last season, huge mental and physical impacts on them. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that this is a consequence of that, but I do think one of the things that, that really we need to think about or maybe just remember is that these guys are people too. Christian Eriksen was not a footballer in those moments. He was a person. He was a father. He was, I don't know if he's a father, but you know what I mean? He was a husband. Mm-hmm. He was a son. He was a brother, a cousin, whatever he was. That's what that brings home, you know, to me anyway.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't agree more.
The Danish players standing around him, protecting him, was really, I think, will be probably the image of the tournament. I can't imagine there will be anything more than that. What did you make of the coverage and the footage of him?
Yeah,
being given CPR and that kind of stuff. How did you feel about that?
The first thing to say is I kind of sympathise with broadcasters in a situation like that because they don't have all the facts. They're making those decisions very fast. Mm. That said, I think as soon as it was clear any kind of CPR was being administrated, I think you have enough facts to know you probably shouldn't be televising it.
Mm.
You know? I don't know, like, if the BBC, I think, who had it in the UK, were responsible for the stream. I doubt that very much.
No, it's UEFA control the coverage.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt, I mean, apparently they cut at one point to his wife in the crowd.
Yeah, she was on the sideline. I think Kasper Schmeichel came over and was, you know, consoling her or talking to her. And
What did you think?
I thought it was intrusive and grotesque. Mm. At times.
I mean, had he died, you know, I think that would have been even more so the case. And it would have been awful, you know.
It felt like reality TV. That's what it felt like. And it's not. And I know pretty much everything is entertainment these days. And football is entertainment. And reality TV is prevalent. And, you know, people willingly expose themselves to television cameras for whatever reason. I can't get my fucking head around it. You know, if you're willing to make a twat of yourself on camera, you can make a good living for yourself, it seems. And many people are prepared, and I'm not talking about acting, James, don't worry. You know, many people are prepared to do that. You know what I mean? But this was not reality TV. This was real life, and this was somebody's life that was in the balance, and we were looking at it. And I do think there need to be some protocols put in place. Thankfully, this kind of thing does not happen with any kind of frequency or regularity. So, you know, I can think of a couple that happened during, you know, let's say the lifetime of Arsblog. We had the Fabrice Muamba. There was Marc Vivien Foe. Do you remember that one? Was that at the African Cup of Nations, I think?
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, but these are really rare events. However, I do think it's important that in the wake of this, there is some sort of discussion between broadcasters or the people that are responsible for providing the pictures to the various broadcasters around the world who can make their own decisions on things as well. They could cut to studio. They could, you know, the producer could cut to a certain shot, whatever, you know, is available to him and everything else. But I find it a little bit hard to take when it is decided for us that we are not allowed to see a nude man or a nude woman run on a football pitch. You know what I mean? Because look, I think it's one of the reasons, obviously, is that if you show them, you maybe encourage that, more people, right? But an injury. We're not allowed to see a replay of a tackle that's caused a serious injury. They've decided that for us, that's too gruesome and that's too grisly for us to be witness to, but cameras can linger on a guy being given CPR when it looks very clearly like he's had a heart attack and is maybe going to die? That doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem right to me. So,
no, I'm with you there, 100%. Hopefully some lessons are learned from this. It's not the first incident of its kind, but maybe it's the first that's been televised quite so widely in Europe, and I think the reaction will hopefully be instructive.
Yeah, well, look, thankfully the news was good and he is going to recover. It just tells you really that for all of us, the most important thing we have is our health.
Mm.
And it sounds a little bit trite. And I know that, well, it's that old saying, isn't it? Death is the great leveler. But really, it's true that regardless of what you have or you don't have in life, good health is the single most important thing. And hopefully he can continue to make a full and speedy recovery. And, you know, I don't know what it means for his football career. I guess they've got some work is the wrong word, but, you know, I guess they're going to have to try and figure out exactly why this happened to him and whether it's the end for his football career. But, you know, I think it's a very obvious choice. If you're being handed life in one hand and a football career in the other, you're choosing life. So
yeah, I imagine, you know, if it comes to that choice, his football career, as much as he must value it enormously, will be placed in some perspective, you would think.
Mm.
Who knows? And I don't know enough medically to know what would be correct. Obviously, Fabrice Mwamba never played again. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure he would have liked to, but equally, I'm sure he wouldn't swap
of course
what he has now and the life he has now. So we shall see. But I'm just glad, so glad that it was kind of a seemingly positive outcome. And as I say, I think it would have cast such a tremendous shadow over the tournament. On every count.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point speculating about what might have happened, you know, or getting angry about what might have happened if the worst had happened, because it didn't. Mm. So, you know, again, all we can say is good luck to him. And thankfully, you know, like you say, he was kind of lucky it happened where it happened. Because of the expertise that was around, and even if it playing out in full view of people was something that was an unfortunate part of this, the fact that it happened in a football stadium with doctors, with equipment, with specialists, with a load of people around who could help him, it's great. And look, good luck to him and good luck to Denmark. It felt a really weird game afterwards, I have to say.
Mm.
It was, you know, they missed a penalty and I don't know. Like I said, I don't know how that...
Which he probably would have taken, yeah.
And
even when Finland scored, the guy seemed sort of apologetic.
Oh.
It was a strange atmosphere. And
How could it not be?
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't know if Denmark's tournament will recover. It's just such a... Like you say, when you've been in that situation of having someone get even a mild injury on a football pitch, you know how it affects you and how it affects the game. Something that serious... I don't quite know how they'll get over that. But, a huge testament to their character that they were able to play at all, to be honest with you.
Mm, so today, what have we got at the Euro Scotland?
Scotland.
Kieran Tierney.
Kieran Tierney. Yeah.
Kieran Tierney against Czech Republic. So that could
be
good. What is the afternoon game?
I don't know. It's Spain versus Sweden in the evening, which I'll be watching because I'm sort of half working on it. And then Poland-Slovakia.
Okay.
Is the 5 p.m.
Right.
Will that be the Robert Lewandowski show? We will find out.
Yeah, probably. Kieran Tierney, we'll be looking to see how Kieran Tierney does. He is, I suppose, beyond Saka, he is the most Arsenal interest we've got in this. So Granit Xhaka, of course, played for Switzerland
against Wales.
How much longer he's going to be an Arsenal player remains to be seen. So, anything else from the Euros or from this bit before maybe we take a break and go into some of the more Arsenal-y transfer stuff, which comes in the way of questions?
Yeah, I think that's all I really had from the Euros. I think let's take a break and get straight into the questions.
Okay, we will do that. We will come back with your questions and more in part two right after this. Learn CPR.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. I'm going to go first, if you don't mind.
By all means.
Right. We have a question, sort of a starter question here from Eddie Longbridge, who's at Eddie Longbridge, and he says, if Ben White is brought in, then who is he replacing? And also, from the Discord, it comes from... Goddamn, why don't I have my glasses on or the text bigger? Biron. He's got three N's at the end of his name, so that's why he's called Biron. He says, what do you think about the price quoted for the Ben White deal? Surely if we're allegedly spending up to £50 million on a centre-back, we have money to burn in other more important positions. Or is this just bad money management? So as somebody who's been reporting on this Arsenal interest in Ben White, give us the sus, James. Give us the lowdown. What's happening, man?
Something that we've talked about quite a lot over the last few months is Arsenal's continuing search for a centre-half. And I know some people have kind of raised eyebrows at that because they have a lot of centre-halves. And in William Saliba particularly, they have a right-sided centre-half who could potentially come into the squad next season. Nonetheless, it appears Arsenal are interested in adding someone in that area. And at the moment, Ben White is the name at the top of the list. They really liked the guy from Sevilla, Jules Koundé. But I think there were reasons that was a difficult deal to do. And so it seems they've moved on to White. And
are you surprised that this guy is the target?
A little bit. I have to be honest and say I've not spent hours and hours watching Brighton games. So, you know, I'll have to be doing my homework on that front. If you look at Ben White's kind of statistical profile, there are really interesting things about him, particularly his ability as a ball carrier. He's someone who can dribble out of defence really effectively. And, you know, that can be really helpful, can take people out of the game. And Arsenal, if you think about what they're losing in David Luiz and his kind of ability on the ball, it does make a degree of sense. I think what is going to surprise people most is going to be the kind of projected fee for the player, right? I mean, I think we reported between 40 and 50 million Brighton would want, and I think that's realistic. I mean, I do think we certainly would be talking north of £40 million for somebody like Ben White, and his Englishness is definitely a factor in that. Of course, his Englishness might be a factor in why Arsenal want him too.
Homegrown.
We've spoken about homegrown quotas, and I do think that's one of the areas they kind of have to focus on in the summer, is making sure that they can flesh out that aspect of it. And also maybe culturally, I do suspect there's a slight thing of, we all remember the kind of failed British core project from a while ago, but everything I hear tells me that people like Kieran Tierney, people like Rob Holding, Callum Chambers are really valued in the group, you know, a kind of different kind of core, not necessarily people who are going to play every game, but people who contribute to the culture. And White is similar age, also part of the England setup. I think also we'll have other suitors. You know, Liverpool have been linked very strongly. I think, who else was it that's been linked very strongly? PSG have been mentioned in dispatches potentially.
Right.
So I think there'll be competition too. So I don't think it's fait accompli, but I think it's something Arsenal are definitely working on. And yeah, I think it has caught people a little bit off guard. What did you make of the news when you saw it?
Well, interesting, certainly, that level of investment could be made in a central defender. I mean, like you, the idea that Arsenal have been after a central defender that's not news. I think no. That's pretty widely known. I was just curious as to what kind of player we were going to bring in. You know, he's not the tallest.
He's about 6 foot, and Koundé's under 6 foot. He's like 5'10" or something like that. So,
right,
that's clearly, you know, not necessarily their concern. I think it has been much more. Well, I think Ben White can defend, but I think a big part of this has been ability on the ball.
Mm.
And Brighton have played some very good football.
He had a very good loan spell at Leeds as well, didn't he?
Yes, I think he was pretty crucial to their promotion campaign, if I'm right. He's also quite versatile. You know, he can play. I think he played for England the other day on the left of a back three. He can play as a right-sided centre-half, obviously. He's played for England as a holding midfielder briefly too. Mm. You know, I think if you think about the way Arsenal play, the demands of that right-sided centre-half role, a lot of the time they're building up kind of in a two or a three, and that player is almost playing at times last season as a kind of right-back or in the channel. And while Rob Holding can kind of get away with that, it's maybe not where he's best. It requires a sort of degree of agility that's maybe not his natural game, may not be the natural game of William Saliba either. So I think Ben White fits the plan in that respect. I think the money thing is just so interesting because if you can do that...
What else can you do?
What else can you do? Because I don't have the impression... that this is kind of the deal that Arsenal are working on, and that's going to be the budget gone.
Yeah.
I do think they see this as one of several significant signings they would want to make to bolster the squad for next season.
Mm.
And so I personally, I'm encouraged by the price. I know people might go, well, you know, is that really how we should be allocating resource? And that's a separate discussion. But the fact that Arsenal feel confident enough that they could reach that sort of price in the circumstances we're in financially is interesting for sure.
It is. And look, here's the thing. I think right-sided centre-half is a position we need to improve on.
Do you? Because not everyone does, right? Everyone sees it as a priority.
I've said this before. I think Rob Holding is a good squad option, a decent squad player. I think he's a good... kind of backs to the wall defender. You know what I mean? If there's a game where you're having to deal with a load of crosses and that kind of stuff, I think that really suits him. But I'm not sure.
Seemingly, as I mentioned earlier, a good person to have around.
Yeah. But I don't think that's the way Arsenal should be looking to play, if you get what I'm saying. You know, we shouldn't be.
Lest we forget, he was very nearly out the door 12 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. The thing people have spoken about a lot in the wake of this interest is obviously if we're spending 40, 50 million pounds on a central defender, we did spend 28 million pounds or do a 28 million pound deal for a central defender 2 years ago now, William Saliba. And while I do think there are scenarios where it doesn't mean the end for Saliba, like, if you're looking to raise a few quid, Rob Holding could be a good sell. You know what I mean? Even if he
is. If you're open to that.
If you're open to that, he's a good sell. He's just signed a new contract. He's English. He's in, you know, the prime years of his career. Maybe there's a scenario whereby Ben White becomes your first choice and Saliba is a backup option to him. Saliba can also play on the left in a back two. He can play in a back three, I'm sure. Do you feel like we're overburdened with central defenders if we bring this guy in? And do you think it means the end for someone? And maybe with Saliba, I mean, it's hard to see a scenario whereby a manager who has got his job on the line is too strong, right? But there's an awful lot of pressure on Mikel Arteta to produce results next season. There aren't many managers in the world who would entrust their one side of their defense to a 20-year-old. Are there?
Not too many. Not too many.
Unless you have no choice.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons they might be paying a premium for Ben White is he is someone who comes with substantial Premier League experience. He's kind of shown he can cut it in this league, which we don't know yet about William Saliba. I think you make a good point about the possibility of selling Holding. Personally, just based on things that I hear about, you know, his presence in the squad and how much the staff like him, I read this as bad news for William Saliba. I do see it that way. And that's my opinion. You know, I'm saying that sort of just looking at it and knowing what we know and seeing what we see about how Arteta feels about Saliba, the fact that he didn't want to use him last summer. I don't really buy that it's changed. And everything that we've heard from Arteta, I feel personally, has been very non-committal. You know, he's always said, of course he'll come back to us in the summer. But he's never said he'll be with us for the duration of next season and I see him as a really important player. Not in a way that's convinced me at any rate. And I don't know if we can carry five centre-halves next season.
Plus Chambers, maybe.
Yeah, who expect minutes as well. It's not like one of them is an academy kid who's 18. Do you know what I mean? Who might get the odd game in the cup, but is basically going to be happy not playing. Or Per Mertesacker at the end of his career being wheeled out on occasion, but basically not being part of the squad. All these guys want to play, expect to play. I mean, we had an interesting question, actually. I'll see if I can find it now. It was about squad building. Here you go. Critical T says, many have said we need to reduce the size of our squad with fewer matches in the coming season. If we achieve our goals next season and make it back into Europe, we'll need a squad capable of playing a season with domestic and European football. Is there a risk our attempts to downsize this year mean that our job in next summer's window will end up being as big as this season's, or even bigger, were we to somehow make it into the Champions League?
Look, I don't think we're going to cut our squad down to like 18 or 16 players. That's just not realistic.
I suppose the reason I ask that is, like, is there a chance that maybe one of these centre-halves could spend this season out on loan, you know, and before coming back?
Well, I mean, if it's Saliba, if it's another loan for William Saliba, it will be 3 years as an Arsenal player in inverted commas, without having played for the club, which is crazy. I can't understand, you know, how the player himself would be on board with that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suspect not. I suspect not.
It's hard not to look at that deal with a crooked eye, to be honest. And this is not a criticism of William Saliba, just to be very clear. But for a football club like Arsenal to spend that much money on an 18-year-old centre-half and for him not to have played for the club in 2 years is just, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is a crazy situation. You know, a huge amount of money to spend on a player who effectively hasn't contributed anything to Arsenal in that time.
Not his fault, of course. Just, you know, that's the reality of the...
And you can debate, I guess, the degree to which the manager is kind of culpable here. You know, Mikel Arteta would probably hold his hands up and say, well, you know, I didn't buy that player. I didn't choose that player. But you could equally say, well, this is the squad you were given to work with. Yeah. Therefore, you need to...
There are a lot of players he didn't buy in the squad that he uses and plays. So, you know, I don't know that it's that one. And I've said this before, I completely understand the thinking behind Was it Arsene Wenger who said, you know, if you play a 20-year-old centre-half, something along those lines, he'll cost you points over the course of the season, you know. And I think everyone can see that. So I was on board with the idea of Saliba going on loan last season. And, you know, we don't need to just sort of relitigate the whole fuck-up we made at the start of the season where 4 months of his career were wasted. But it does feel like there is some level of incompatibility between him and Mikel Arteta, for sure. I mean, it's dividing line, it's boundary line type stuff for some fans as well, which I think is really very interesting. I think it's an interesting phenomenon that there is this this sort of staunch level of support for Saliba. And I get why people are invested in it. We, you know, paid a lot of money. He looks an exciting young player, an exciting young defender. We've had our fill of annoying, error-prone, Hank Scorpio-looking fucking central defenders in our time. You know, so I get why people are invested in him and the idea of him. But it is kind of more the idea of him at the moment, isn't it? Because we don't have any evidence of what he can do for us in an Arsenal shirt. And maybe it's a sort of circular thing because he hasn't been given that chance. But I think it is
It's definitely strange. It's definitely strange. And, you know, if there is an opportunity to recoup a significant chunk of what Arsenal have paid for him, maybe it is the time to take it. If it just isn't compatible between player and coach at this point, maybe that's the way it goes. I do wonder, though, about a loan. The only reason I say that is he's still under contract with Arsenal for quite a while. And also, if things go badly for Mikel Arteta in the first 6 months of next season, there might be a change at managerial level. And then where does that leave, you know, the Saliba situation? How much does that influence things? It's a really delicate one. And I suspect you're right. The player's own wishes will be a big factor in it. You know, is he going to be content with the uncertainty of another loan spell? Is he really committed or bothered about the idea of playing for Arsenal at this point after so long, with so many setbacks and problems? How determined is he to kind of, you know, see this through? I don't know. But it's a really odd one. And I think you're right. It is a kind of line in the sand for a lot of fans. I think when you make a big signing, there's a lot of emotional investment in that. We've seen that with Pepe and with others. People want that to pay off and work out. And, you know, Saliba's kind of being filed, I think, next to sort of Matteo Guendouzi and Mesut Ozil as players that Arteta, but for some fans, hasn't given a sufficient chance. And what I would say is Ozil and Guendouzi, from what I could see, had a lot more chances than Saliba.
Yeah. And I don't really know that anything Guendouzi or Ozil have done since leaving really strengthens their cases. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, Saliba had a better loan with Nice than Guendouzi did with Hertha, for sure.
So,
very odd, very curious.
Look, the bottom line is we've got to give him a chance in the team so we can decide that he's overrated and we don't like him and it's time for someone else.
At least give us the opportunity to make that decision for ourselves. Don't leave us not knowing, you know? Just give us a little glimpse. We can see him put a pass into touch and say, all right, sling him out. That's all they need to do. It's going to be a really interesting one, and I suspect might be one of those cases that plays out slightly longer over the summer. You know, probably he will come back and join up with the squad. Probably there will be discussions with the manager. Probably they will have a look at him as opposed to a Rob Holding or a Pablo Marie or whoever else it might be. But I agree with you, one of those centre-halves I don't think is going to be in the squad next season. I just don't think we've got the games, because you're right. You've got Callum Chambers who can play there as well. You've even got, in an absolute bind, people like Kieran Tierney or Mohamed Elneny who've slotted in there before. I just think we don't need five senior centre-halves.
It will be very interesting to see how it plays out, because, look, we're all, you know, looking at what's happening and looking at it from a distance without all the information, you know, the fear is obviously this is going to be very negative for William Saliba. But look, nothing has happened yet, so we are speculating, and let's see how it plays out. But you know, it wouldn't surprise me if our interest in another central defender brought about, at the very least, another loan move for Saliba. Mm. I mean, what do you make of this? Kieran E. on the Discord said, if we're one of the best defensive teams in the league last season, and our priority signing seems to be a central defender when we already have four or five, are our priorities wrong this summer? And I think it's an interesting discussion, isn't it? Because everyone wants us to be more creative, to score yeah. more goals, to make more chances, etc., etc. And we're being linked with a defender. I mean, is there any issue with the club doing business like this as long as all the other stuff gets done first? Doesn't yeah, really I mean, matter, I think, does it?
I guess we're inferring from the fact that this is the deal that we've heard about, mm. that's the priority. And I think it's more complex than that. Firstly, we know for a fact that they have worked and are working on other deals.
Mm.
It's just that this is the one that has come to light. And I guess it's a big chunk of money, so people are talking about it in those terms. But I think it's very difficult for us to really contextualize that fee until we see what else they spend in other areas. You know, mm. if it's like, oh, guess what? We only had $9.99 left to spend on a number 10, yeah. then that'll be rather different. But I don't think that is the case. And I think a creative midfielder is still the priority, if anything. I strongly suspect that's still Martin Odegaard. But there's obviously a lot of problems around potentially doing that deal. I don't think it'd be straightforward. And it might be one that they're waiting on news from Madrid for. You know, there's a new manager there. There's probably discussions to be had about what his role would be with Real. So I understand the frustration of we don't score enough goals, we're being linked with the centre-half, but I don't think we can infer from that they're not trying to address other problems. I also think that maybe there are things a centre-half can bring you that can help. I mean, if you think about what Arsenal looked like, to my eyes anyway, with and without David Luiz last season, I think there was a palpable difference. And if you've got someone at the back who can really help you progress the ball, inevitably it's going to give you more opportunities at the other end of the pitch. So I think these things are linked, even though it may feel kind of backwards.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, if there are worries or, you know, I do think perhaps the David Luiz as the master distributor thing was a bit overcooked, you know, because he could pick a pass, you know, but a footballer who can pass a football shouldn't be that surprising. But I do see what Luiz brought to us in terms of some of his distribution from deep and the way that he could use the ball. So, yeah, maybe it does help. Maybe it does help if you've got, you know, a smart passer or someone who can carry the ball out of defence to sort of pull teams apart a little bit. If that can help you attack, that makes a lot of sense. So maybe that's part of it, you know?
Yeah, could be. We had a question about Calv, actually. Calv Tom Zero says, off the back of the England performance, what did you make of Calvin Phillips? Colossal performance in the midfield. I've been banging his drum for a while as the kind of player Arsenal need, and he's homegrown. Would he be a good Neves alternative?
Is he the same kind of player as Neves? I don't know. I mean, he was very good yesterday, wasn't he? He was really very good.
He was, actually.
And he got away with a lot of fouls. Which
is a useful skill as a footballer.
Would immediately lose that if he became an Arsenal player.
That's true.
He was like, ref, it's my first foul. Yeah, but you're an Arsenal player, yellow card. He's a good player. I think he looks a good player. What age is he? About 24?
25. I mean, I would say maybe this is one where you'd have to tread very carefully, just because we know about tournament inflation, particularly regarding English players, you know, who have Owen Hargreaves comes back from the Euros, a £50 million player or whatever it is. Like, it does feel like this happens a little bit. Probably has already happened with Ben White to an extent.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yeah, getting called up and getting his first couple of caps. You know, if Calvin Phillips keeps playing like this, what will his asking price be by the end of the summer? You know, something absolutely ludicrous. I think he is a good player, but I guess what Arsenal probably needs to do is catch these players before they're starting regularly for England. And maybe that is what they think they might be doing with Ben White.
With Ben White, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that does make a lot of sense. If you're looking at a transfer strategy where you're trying to not unearth hidden gems, because I don't know that they exist anymore, but if you're looking to, you know, bring in players who can develop at the football club, it makes a lot more sense, doesn't it, than buying these sort of end-of-career guys or bringing in guys whose experience is supposed to get you where you need to go, but in the end it doesn't. So,
yeah,
maybe the ship has sailed a little bit with Calvin Phillips in terms of his price.
I fear it may have done. I mean, on the subject of Ruben Neves, Portugal play Hungary tomorrow, Tuesday.
Right.
I don't know if he's expected to start, but I know he's, you know, quite often a regular with Portugal, so it might be worth keeping an eye out, get a look of him at a different team other than Wolves. I know a few fans watched him in one of the warm-up friendlies and he was quite impressive on that day, so yeah, it could be worth one keeping an eye out for.
Okay, at Lock Your Jonathan says, do we really need that many transfers? Happy with defence and attack. Chambers and Cedric cover right back, maybe a left back cover, Odegaard or similar in midfield. Even open to cleaning out the forward line with a core of Leno, Holding, Tierney, Partey, Saka, Smith-Rowe, Pepe. Very strong to build around. And I think the dichotomy of the transfer window is summed up by this one from the Discord, which says, isn't it mad that in the later Wenger years we were apparently always just one or two signings from a title-challenging team. Not that we ever made those signings. And now we barely know where to start with signings. How did we get here? So do we need lots of signings or not that many or just the classic one or two?
Well, I think we had a question last week about what would be the kind of bare minimum, you know, and I think, I forget exactly, but we ended up with about four that we were like, really, those need to get done. And I stand by that sort of tally, really, in those sorts of areas. I think the question is right. I think we've got some really exciting players, especially young players, to kind of build around and work with. But there are clear gaps. You know, we're talking about number 10 as being one. I think certainly if Granit Xhaka goes, and arguably even if he doesn't, just with Danny Ceballos gone, there's a gap in central midfield in the deeper areas. I think there's clearly a gap goalkeeper behind Bernd Leno, where someone needs to come in. So, yeah, I think there are a number of areas that are weak and need strengthening. As for the kind of one or two signings things, I mean, what's really changed is our league position, hasn't it? I mean, we always felt we were in touching distance, and I think a lot of other clubs have kind of overtaken us, certainly in terms of their recruitment, and it's left us in a position where it feels like we are further away. I wonder as well how much of that is down to having a clear style. I mean, with Wenger, it always felt like we had an attacking game that was absolutely, what's the word? That worked. It worked, essentially.
Yeah.
And we had one problem, which is that defensively we were poor. So we needed a centre-half and a holding midfield player, perennially.
Yeah, which is why we went and bought Andre Arshavin.
Exactly. And we kind of never really addressed that issue. I think maybe with Arteta's Arsenal, the style is less coherent, less clear. And so it's more difficult to go, well, if we only added a right back, everything would be fixed. But
yeah,
I think number 10 is the one, really. I think that is the one that has to be the most important, because defensively our record is decent. I think I'm going to have to go and deal with that dog in a minute. But I think, you know, we need to create more chances. We need to score more goals. That's the one that, if we haven't addressed it come the end of the summer, I think it's going to put a serious limit on our potential for next year.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think people are kind of more forgiving is the wrong word. But I think if you're a team that can score a lot of goals, it does go some way to you're obviously doing something right if you're scoring lots of goals. You're doing kind of the most important thing in football, right? So it's finding that balance between defensive solidity and creating those chances and scoring the goals where, you know, that that appears to have happened with us in that we do have a defensive record that stacks up relatively well. It doesn't feel like it all the time, but it's true. But the issue is we don't score enough goals and don't make enough chances. And that's maybe a consequence of how we're being set up to be more defensively solid. So do you want to have a word with the dog or?
Yeah, I think she's woken up and she is like, oh shit, I'm alone. And she hates to be alone. So I'm going to go and show her that I am alive and in the house. And
okay.
Hopefully that will reassure her.
Okay.
Give me 1 second.
No problem.
Oh, you're loud, actually. Right. Shush. Shush.
That's it. Dogs understand English perfectly. They do, though, actually. Mine do, anyway. Can't say a word. Maybe we need a dog jingle to put in here to sort of fill the dead air. Too hungover for the chit chat.
Hello.
Hello, you're back. She okay?
Back. She's
feeling
quiet.
Better.
Let's hope it lasts.
Let's hope it lasts. Is it my question or your question? I don't know whose question it is.
I don't know, actually. Have you got one there? I've got one, actually. Don't worry.
Okay.
The Admiral on Twitter, at Jim Marquis. Jim Marquis? Marquis? Don't know. If Arsenal extend Eddie's contract to protect his value, do you think they will send him out on loan to increase his value? Or do you think, pardon me, that's my hangover. Or do you think they will keep him in the squad?
I don't know why Eddie Nketiah would sign a contract.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. I can see why the club would offer him an extension.
Mm.
Even if you're going to sell him this summer. Selling a player who's got 2 years left on his deal, or three, or four, or five, is likely to extract a bigger fee than selling a player who's got one.
Yeah, but from the player's point of view, you've got far... I mean, you're likely to have more offers...
Absolutely.
...when your contract is coming to an end because your price is lower, the club know you want to go, etc., etc. So while it makes some sense for Arsenal to try and do it, it doesn't really... make any sense from the player's point of view, and I don't know why his agent would advise him to do that. Same agent as Saka, isn't it? And
same agent as Saka, Balogun, a few others. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think Arsenal probably are just trying to protect the investment. The player's aware of that, you would imagine. So why would he do that when this summer or even next? He's got incredible options, you know, lots of choice, you would think. I still think the likelihood is he'll leave, to be honest with you.
I think so too. I mean, there must have been, in the discussions with Balogun, you know, over his contract, this is the same agent. So what is Edu telling the agent to convince Balogun to sign a new deal at Arsenal when he did have options, you know, to go to clubs in Europe and maybe play more regularly at an earlier age. You know, Edu has got to, I mean, not that Nketiah is the elephant in the room, but he's certainly got to be a factor in the discussions because you're telling an agent one thing about one of his clients, which is probably going to have a negative impact on another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how you possibly can manage that situation. I think it's really tricky.
Mm.
two strikers, same agent, competing for the same spot in the squad, essentially.
Mm.
I also think Eddie's 22 now. He needs to play. I think he really does need to go and get some proper minutes. I mean, he's not had a substantial loan spell. He went to Leeds for half a season, wasn't really a starter there.
Mm.
So he's never really played a full season of senior football and seen where that takes him. I think he needs to do that for his own career. And I think he will. I think he'll sort of try and wrest control of his career, to be honest. And I don't think he'll sign that contract. I think he'll find somewhere to go and hopefully Arsenal strike a deal. But
what do you make of I've seen people criticise the club for not selling him in January, for example.
Yeah.
You know, and previous to January, he was involved on a semi-regular basis. He'd started some games in the Premier League. At one point, which is a testament to how bad we were, he was our leading scorer last season. Mm. So where do you stand on the idea that we should have sold him in January because he was a more valuable asset? Was there the chance to sell him in January? Was anyone interested? I mean, we didn't use him much in the second half of the season, and, you know, thusly, his value has diminished. But, like, I'm not sure there were a pile of clubs knocking down our door for Eddie Nketiah in January, were there?
I don't know. But I suspect that if there were any, Mikel Arteta's very public dismissal of the possibility of selling him may have dampened some of that interest.
Mm.
I think it's very... Well, look, certainly with hindsight, that would have been the right thing to do. Mm. I think a lot of people argued it at the time too. I think the return of Gabriel Martinelli from injury, albeit a kind of cagey return around that time of year, meant that with Aubameyang, Lacazette, don't forget as well, we just transitioned to using Aubameyang through the middle, I think, in that kind of period, and playing with a number 10 in Smith Rowe, and then Odegaard came in. I think we probably could have afforded to let Eddie go, either permanently or even temporarily. I mean, you know, half a season of Premier League football, if he'd scored half a dozen goals, probably would have put another 5 million on his price tag or whatever it might be. I don't think that would have been the worst thing in the world either. Or shown us something that we've not seen from him thus far. He might have done something similar to what Joe Willock has achieved, you know?
Mm.
But we didn't do that, and ultimately the second half of his campaign felt like stagnation. He didn't really get any minutes, didn't really get any opportunities, didn't really make any strides forward. And I think suffered a real blow, obviously, with the England 21s. They went out at the group stage of that tournament, meaning he didn't have any competitive football this summer with knockouts, which again would have been a really good platform for him, you would think. So, yeah, I think it probably was a mistake to not let him leave in that time. And I expect it's one they'll put right. But I don't get the impression that the contract offer they've made to Eddie is one that says to him,
yeah, you're the future.
Part of our future.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the subject of strikers, Jack Linehan, who's at JJ15Q on Twitter, says, morning, gents. Very curious. Do you really think losing Lacazette and a free next year is that bad? Keep him this season, as there will be games that suit him, and not give him a big contract should free up the wage bill nicely.
I don't think it's that bad if they make a number of other sales. You know, it does kind of feel, in isolation, it's bad. You know, a £50 million player leaving for nothing. You can't really argue that's anything but bad. But if they were to recoup, you know, £80 million in cash from other sales and said, made a kind of technical case of, we want to keep Lacazette for an extra year because, you know, Balogun and Martinelli aren't quite ready yet, then I could live with it. But I know others will disagree. I suspect you'll disagree with that.
Yeah, I think it would be bad. I think it would. I mean, I can see a football rationale for it, but I think there comes a point where, as a club, you have to stop doing bad things.
And letting- I guess I'm kind of talking on the assumption that maybe there isn't interest at the level where it becomes worth it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
I don't know.
True.
But if someone comes in, they're like, do you want 5 million for Lacazette? I do wonder if it might be like, well, no, I'd rather have Lacazette, sort of thing.
Yeah. Maybe that, yeah, maybe you get more goals than that 5 million is worth, if that makes sense.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
But
yeah.
as a general kind of rule, we have to stop letting players go for free.
I agree with that. For sure. And if someone comes in at an appropriate price, I think Arsenal absolutely have to take it. And obviously people will have different opinions on what that price should be. But, you know, anything north of kind of 10 million sterling, I think you need to look at very, very seriously.
Yeah.
For the difference it can make. But it will come down to how much faith I think Arteta has in Martinelli and Balogun too. You know, I don't think they're in a hurry. I don't think they're desperate to add a number nine to the list of other business they have to attend to this summer. And I don't know. You know, we've spoken about Arteta being kind of wary of relying on a very young centre-half. Would he be wary of relying on a very young centre-forward too?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. A lot of people have asked this and qualified it by saying, well, I can't see anybody else has asked this, but one from the Discord.
They've asked nonetheless.
Two Gun Pete says, at Gunnerblog, Bissouma?
Bissouma.
I think that's how he's saying it. He goes, Bissouma?
Yeah, Bissouma. I mean, after the Buendia outrage, Bissouma's the one to watch, I think, isn't it? In terms of kind of fan disappointment if you don't get him.
Yep.
I blame Clive Palmer for this. I think he's so insightful and articulate that when he says a player is good, anyone who has listened to him on a podcast immediately, I do it too, kind of subsumes that view. By osmosis, it becomes their position.
Clive Moses.
Exactly. Bissouma, I mean, all I know about Bissouma is what I've said elsewhere, which is that, you know, the club like him, he's on a list. I don't know that he's necessarily number one on that list. It doesn't feel that way. But I might be wrong. I know for a fact that in every position, Arsenal have a kind of ABCD of who they want. And while it can be possible to extract or figure out who that A, B, and C and D are, it's very difficult to know who's A. And I don't know on Bissouma. I do wonder if they might be looking for something slightly different in midfield. You know, when you think about the way Arteta's teams play and have played to date, I do just wonder, you know, if Xhaka really is going to go, and obviously it seems like he wants to and that Roma would like to sign him, I do just wonder if that skill set, someone who's more analogous, shall we say, with Xhaka might be the target. I mean, you know, and Neves, in terms of his range of passing, the kind of distribution he offers, I know Bissouma can pass as well, but I just feel like stylistically, is that going to be more of a fit? What do you think?
I genuinely don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe some of the stuff that people are looking for from a Bissouma, you know, could be part of Partey's game. When he's fully
fit.
That's
the other thing that I sort of think. Yeah, I know they're very different, but equally there is overlap in some areas.
Yeah. And look, I'm really just quite interested. As much as anybody, I want us to make signings, but I'm really interested to see what kind of signings we make and what that tells us about what way we're going to develop this team, you know? Because it'll tell us a lot stylistically about what we can expect from next season, you know, if, for example, let's say we sell Lacazette and we bring in a sort of mid-age, mid-20 striker, that would be quite interesting to me. Or are they going to, you know, are they going to entrust Martinelli and Balogun to back up Aubameyang, that kind of thing. So I'm really just interested to see what kind of player comes in, what it tells us about what way we're going to play. Like, you know, there's, if Bissouma is on the list, apparently Neves is on the list as well. They're very different players, you know.
Yeah, they are. And then
does that
another
speak to
name
two
is,
midfield
is
the signings?
Guy Anderlecht, Lokonga,
yeah.
who again is a different type. You know, someone who is a ball carrier, really. Someone who can dribble. He has got a good range of passing on him as well. But you know, there is a real mix of qualities there, and I guess it'll be about finding a chemistry. Mm. Right? It won't just necessarily be about signing like-for-like players, but having a mix that enables Arteta to do different things in different games too.
Mm.
It is really, it's a puzzle that's being pieced together before our eyes, and we're kind of trying to read the tea leaves and see what we might end up with. I am sort of at the point where, I wouldn't say I've been sucked in, but I am at the point where I am excited for change. You know, I'm excited to see new players, new things from this Arsenal team. And that hasn't quite translated into optimism yet.
Mm.
But
I know what you mean.
I'm ready for, you know, something slightly fresh next season.
Okay. Almost time to go, but we have one here from... We had one here from the Discord and I've lost it. Okay, yeah, we've got a couple of listeners here with some big problems. Rick Stomatic on the Discord said, my wife got this bird feeder for the garden. It told me it would attract the nice little birds, you know, the cute ones. Mm. It hasn't, and now my garden just gets magpies coming in and shitting everywhere. What can I do to stop these terrible creatures? And on Twitter, we have one from... God, I'm fucking hopeless today. That's the hangover. Joshy Gooner, who's at Joshy Abbott, says, question for Gunnar Blog. Magpies have been dropping bread on me from above while I sit in my garden. Is this a declaration of peace or war?
They've been dropping bread. Whatever you do, do not eat that bread. I suspect it's laced with poison.
Or LSD or something like that. They want to get you...
Exactly. An act of kindness from a magpie is always to be treated with suspicion. I don't remember who said that. I think it was... Shakespeare or Oscar Wilde,
yeah,
someone
definitely.
Like that.
Yeah, Oscar Wilde. Yeah, sounds like his.
But I'm fascinated by the problem of the bird feeder. I mean,
it's like putting a shark attractor in your fucking swimming pool and then saying, "Well, fuck, I didn't think there'd be any sharks."
Yeah. I just dragged a carcass behind my boat, hoping it would attract, you know,
yeah, the nice
little goldfish,
Nemo. Just wanted
exactly.
Nemo.
I just hope Nemo would swim up to the surface with his dad and smile at me.
Yeah.
And instead, you've got a great
Jaws.
White. The magpie is the great white of the skies. It is. You know magpies' beaks? When they open their beaks, they've got razor teeth in there. Like a shark, 400 teeth in every magpie beak.
There is a new magpie fact that I didn't know. I just assumed that when a magpie opened its beak, another smaller little alien magpie head came out as well.
But they say if you look into a magpie beak, it's like you lose your mind. Like it's like staring into a black hole and people never recover from it.
So the only advice we can give is, A, get rid of the bird feeder. Because
yeah, straight away burn that.
It's a magpie attractor. That's what it's actually.
I want
about.
A video sent to us of that being set alight in the garden. While the magpies watch on.
Yeah, in horror. They'll get their revenge though. They will.
Well, that's the issue. I mean
so you're doomed
if he takes
now.
The bird feeder away, how will they respond? By dropping bread on him? Poisoned bread?
Who knows? I think the only option this guy has is to move house now. Just move house.
His only option
disguise.
Is to live underground. That's the only safe place.
From magpies, yeah.
Yeah.
Become a mole man.
A subterranean society.
Free from the yoke of magpie tyranny at last. Although
exactly.
With slightly poorer eyesight and less hygienic living conditions. It's quite muddy
Absolutely.
Down there, I believe. Yeah. All right.
Right.
Shall we go? All right, listen, thank you everyone for being here. Thanks as always for listening, downloading, subscribing, and all the rest. We've got something for Patreon members midweek. Watch out for that regular Arsecast on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the Euros, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.